Hello everyone, and this is Discerning Consciousness with Mike and Ant-Man.
Hi everyone.
This week we'll be discussing the scientific underpinnings of spirituality. We are covering the subject because there is a common misconception that they are diametrically opposed camps of understanding the world. And I think it's really good to mention a Carl Sagan quote here, which is, "The notion that science and spirituality are somehow mutually exclusive does a disservice to both." And he definitely knew what it was on about.
Indeed, so it does
give a bit of veracity to the subject matter today.
It's a good quote to start with, Mike.
So we're just going to start off with defining a couple of terms. Because in the common consensus of understanding, science, spirituality, religion are all chucked around, but many people misunderstand what they truly mean, don't you think so?
I can relate to that, certainly when it comes to science terms, so it'd be very useful to hear them picked apart a bit.
Yeah, so let's start off with science.
Yeah.
And I will say, a lot of the times, people misunderstand the fact that science truly is a methodology of exploring and understanding the world.
Yeah.
But it's common these days for science to be seen as a religion in its own right, essentially.
Or an ideology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's very much supported by certain Richard Dawkins books that have been released.
Yeah, let's not give him too much publicity. He's got enough already.
Yeah, so it's very important to realise that it's the scientific method, not science as a body of knowledge, that we talk about.
So that's when we're talking about science, it's related to the methodology.
Yeah, method of discovery. Yeah. That's what it truly is.
Yeah.
And the reason why there's a lot of misunderstanding with science and religion, per se, is certain things that we're left with since Christianity came about.
Right.
Because in the old days of the philosophers, they were the scientists, they were the great thinkers, they were the not so much the religiousness, but very much the spiritualness of it all.
Sure.
But when Christianity came along, it started chucking things out. Right. So science and logic went on one side, and religion and spirituality were
so
on the other.
So that's where the separation began.
Yeah.
And we're referring to figures obviously like Plato, Aristotle.
Yeah, the real great thinkers of the old Greek philosophers. Mm. But going back to this whole religion and spirituality, it's only been in the last, since the 60s, really.
Mm.
So that's, 50 years now.
Yeah.
That spirituality and religion have been divorcing themselves again. Because you're realising that religion is just a regimental, dogmatic viewpoint. So it's not a about discovering.
No.
It's just about do this, do that.
Doctrine.
Yes.
Yeah.
But spirituality has separated itself now to be its own method of discovery.
Yeah.
Again, it's a different method of discovery than science. It's not as rigorous. It's more kind of like, how do you feel about that? Rather than kind of like, what's the results?
So what it really needs is science to give it the rigour.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so. But it's interesting to note that the more you look into the science and the more you look into the spirituality, how they're not opposed at all, and they're actually saying the same things, but it's just the language they use makes it seem like they're saying different things.
Also interesting to add, Mike, this point on religion and spirituality, how when you talk to people, that you might say to someone who is not into spiritualism or esotericism in any way, you say to them, you know, about your interest in spirituality, they'll say, well, does that mean you're religious then? By default, they think you're religious.
It's exactly. Like,
well, not necessarily.
And that's going back to the fact that those terms have been clumped together for so long now.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to understand that they're different. But then again, I always find that when I say to people that I believe in God. And they go, so which religion are you with then?
They can't get their heads around it, can they?
Yeah, so, you know, that's why we just wanted to clear those terms up to begin with. But before we get into the heart of it, I just wanted to go over a few great quotes that come from some real great scientists from our time. So let's start off with one by Tesla.
Yeah.
And he said, The day science begins to study non-physical phenomena, it will make more progress in one decade than in all the previous centuries of its existence.
That's a good summary, isn't it?
Yeah. And what that's basically getting to is the idea that it's not the physical particles that we see and feel in everyday life that is the important thing.
So they don't have primacy, if you like.
Yeah, well, that leads on to the Einstein quote. And he says, the field is the sole governing agency of the particle. And again, quite science-y, but what it's saying there is the particle is the secondary to the fields that are the primary. And that's kind of like flipping the viewpoint of what is materialism at the end of the day.
So can we say then that mainstream science, if you will, traditionally has had the counter view to that?
Yeah, yeah. It's always, well, the very name, physics. It's all about physical things.
Having the primary.
Yeah, yeah. It's a well-known fact that physics always likes to put a particle to something that's going on. Even light that's a wave is actually modelled as a particle with the photon. But that's a great debate within physics of the wave-particle dualities, which is, again, a kind of misconception which comes into the idea of modelling. So, yes, light is a wave. It's just a wave. But the higher frequency that wave is, the more it looks like a particle. And that's why they'll talk about light, photons of light, as particles, because it's a modelling thing.
As with any discipline, though, we find the difficulty comes with dealing with the paradox, because we like things tightly defined in little boxes.
Well, I have to admit, there is no such things as paradoxes. It's just a lack of understanding of what it really is.
That's a nice scientific angle,
Paradoxes disappear with true understanding.
Yeah.
So one thing I just want to go over is the fact that Isaac Newton, one of the greatest physicists of our time, spent more time studying alchemy, the esoteric arts, and the hermetic principles than he ever did physics itself.
Right, that's interesting.
So even though he's known as the grandfather of physics, that was just a hobby for him, where his true nature lie in the alchemy.
So what you're saying is what we've publicly become known for, what he's known for, it isn't actually really what he was about.
Well, yeah. Well, he was about understanding everything. So he was like a true scientist. He didn't cut out the esoteric side of it just because it wasn't mainstream.
No.
He looked at everything.
He was using a truly forensic approach to him, wasn't he?
Exactly. And that's what science is all about at the end of the day. And a lot of people in this day and age have forgotten that. But if we get into the real heart of it now, and that lies with a majorly misunderstood area of physics, which is quantum physics.
Right.
Because the big thing about quantum physics is it brings in the idea of there's an observer.
Right. That's at the root of quantum physics.
Yeah, because normally speaking, physics tries to be very mechanistic in the way of describing the universe.
Right.
So you don't need a human being involved for it to work.
So it doesn't take account of consciousness.
Exactly. But as soon as you get onto quantum physics, you get what's known as the observer problem. So depending on where and how you observe a phenomena happening
will affect the result.
Exactly. And this comes into the idea that quantum physics is just trying to predict the probability of an outcome.
Right.
And yes, in the mechanistic way, it's viewing, say, the outcome of a certain particle or a group of particles. Doesn't really normally try and view an outcome of anything much bigger than that, because the mathematics becomes far too complex. So, yeah, it's trying to work out the probability of a certain outcome. But the observation comes in and can change that outcome.
So when did quantum physics first, you know, emerged in?
When it emerged around the turn of the century, 1900s, 1910, that sort of period. And there was great debate in how to view this new modern physics.
Was it seen as quite heretical to, like, mainstream science at the time when it first emerged?
Yeah, because it was going against the old standard physics.
So anything new is always put in that kind of lie, isn't it?
Yeah, the results, no one could understand it because they were no longer mechanistic.
No, sure.
And this is where you truly learn that the whole process of quantum physics is actually the true understanding of what the spiritualist community would understand as the manifestation process.
It certainly gives a good underpinning for the spiritual perspective of manifestation, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's hard to kind of like tie in perfectly.
Yeah.
But then again, humankind doesn't really understand quantum physics properly yet, so there's a lot more to
be
done there.
It's a process, isn't it?
But the whole idea of the manifestation process of you're thinking of your outcome to make your outcome happen ties in heavily with the idea that it's the way you observe a situation affects its outcome. So they're tied in together quite heavily. And a very easy way to describe that would be... the well-documented case of the Emoto experiments with the ice crystals. So, I think you know a little bit about that, don't you, Anthony?
Oh, yeah, we have, because he obviously, he set up an experiment, didn't he, where he had love and hate, didn't he?
Yeah.
Where they were labelled, and then obviously you have two different emotions, which formed, the one with love formed really beautiful shaped crystals, didn't it? And the one with
very
hate,
geometric patterns,
whereas the one which was labelled with hate, they were like discordant patterns, weren't they?
Yeah. And I have to admit, that's, even within the science community, that's poorly misunderstood, that experiment.
And why is that then?
Because a lot of people will take the idea that it was the label that was written on the bottle.
Oh, that's not the main thing, is it?
No, it's the person's perspective when they're viewing that label.
Mm.
The reason I say this is because they've actually done a double-blind study, which means that the person doing the experiment didn't know what the label said. It was covered over with
It could have anything written on it.
You know, so when they're covered over and you don't see if it's love or you don't see it's hate, you're not projecting with your mind that idea.
So again, it's not the actual words,
it's the intent, the viewpoint, your perception of it. And that's why you say it's the consciousness viewpoint that comes into it. And talking about that, the next stage of that would be almost what's known as the placebo or the nocebo effect.
Okay, so what's the difference between those two then?
Well, the placebo effect is where you can actually cure yourself with just the idea of you're thinking you're taking, say, a medical pill that's curing your disease.
So would that be...
Where in fact, it's just a sugar pill.
So would that be essentially the strength of someone's belief?
Yeah, your very mind is overcoming the matter and solving the problem. Whereas the nocebo effect is its counter opposite, which is most notably seen where hypochondriacs will actually make themselves ill just because they believe they are so strongly.
So they will manifest illness.
Exactly.
But we can also see that with people who have like this idea of like a poverty consciousness, whereby they just talk about lack all the time.
I have no money, or
they see money as an evil, and of course what happens, they don't magnetize money towards themselves.
Exactly. I mean, that's why I tie physics and spirituality together so closely, because they really are saying the same things in that sense.
And on a sort of very everyday level of, say, if we zoom it right down to everyday life, on the level of personal development and just living more fulfilling lives, having this understanding helps, doesn't it?
Definitely. I mean, the more you know, the more you can do with
it.
But coming back to the placebo idea, one thing I did want to just bring into the consciousness of everyone is how in the medical industry, it's a standard thing that you test all new pills or medicines against the placebo effect.
Right. You're talking about when pharmaceutical companies do the testing. Yeah.
So they'll give one group the real cure and they'll give another group the sugar pill to test if, say, just the believing it will cure you will cure you. And the fact is, even though they will always test it against the placebo effect because it was a well-documented thing, they will never push the placebo effect to the point where you don't need the medicine, you just need the belief that you've got
medicine. There's no profit in that, is there, Mike?
Exactly. And that's why it's never pushed. But it's an interesting point that I wanted to make, because it really does add veracity to this idea.
It's a good point you make, because I haven't heard other people talk about it. And it's quite a logical, straightforward point to make, really. Well, why doesn't this happen?
Exactly. So that's why we just want to cover those points. And that pretty much wraps up the whole quantum physics manifestation process in that understanding.
Yeah.
But to move on now, one of the big underpinning things within physics, and I think I mentioned it briefly earlier, was the whole wave-particle duality.
Okay, so we're talking about frequencies.
Yeah, well, all waves are measured in their frequency, but in the cornice they are a wave.
Yeah.
And all waves have a frequency, amplitude, and various other properties. And the reason I mention that is because they pop up again and again and again within physics. And just like Tesla and Einstein were trying to push the idea behind, is the fact that everything is waves.
Mm.
Even the particles are waves. Mm. It's just the way we see them, we model them as particles. Mm. And the easiest way to see this is in the concept of kinematica.
Right, and what's that then?
It's the idea of putting a sound wave through a plate of metal, and then putting loads of sand or various other particular matter on top of it. And depending on the frequency of the sound wave they put in, will actually change the shape that those sand particles will create on that plate.
So would it be the case, say, if they played a frequency that was discordant, then the patterns would be discordant, and if they played a frequency that was more harmonic, you'd get more harmonic patterns, or is it not quite as simple as that?
Well, in a sense, you are correct there. But what you find is when you get a harmonic pattern, you get these perfect geometric patterns. But when you get a discordant frequency going through it, what you'll find is it's continuously morphing between...
Oh, so shifting.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. And that's what you find. It's like null spaces between perfect harmonies, where it kind of like isn't in one and isn't in the other, so it's constantly going back and forth between the two.
During, say, an experiment, you'd see that with the little particles they use, where it'd be constantly shifting.
Yeah. So just have a look at kinematica if you haven't before, and you'll see exactly
what
we're on about.
I've seen some of them on YouTube. It's really interesting.
But really, to bring that into a more spiritual aspect, one of the things I find fascinating is how certain sound waves or sound frequencies can actually affect the different chakras within the body.
Yeah, they relate, don't they, to the chakra.
Because one of the things I always found when I was learning about the chakras is, okay, it's quite an interesting concept, I get the idea, but it always was a subject to study rather than experience.
It's the question of how do you ground it.
Yeah, and it wasn't until I went through certain sound-type experiences that really activated certain chakras within the body. And suddenly it went from being on the page to being an experience I could feel.
So what were those experiences you had then?
Well, mine were more based within something called binaural beats.
Again, there's a lot on YouTube, isn't there?
Yeah.
So
certain binaural beats with the solfeggio frequencies can actually affect different chakra points within the body. And you can actually feel these points actually being energised in a way.
So you can feel them resonate.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So it's something you should definitely check out if you haven't already, because, again, it's a fantastic area of research.
Recently, I had my experience of sound frequencies. I went to a gong bath. Sounds really grand. Essentially, it's where you get people, they lie down and they play these. I think they're originally from Tibet. The drums, the sort of flat ones.
I think so, but I'm not sure on that.
But anyway, that was for about an hour, and that was a very, really powerful experience. The thing I'd equate it to, the sound that was being produced, was a bit like the universe, the ebb and flow. It was like this current that went out and in, out.
Oh, brilliant.
And
I'll have to experience that sometime.
Yeah, it was very good.
All right, so if we just talk a little bit now about some ancient symbols that you see appear over and over again within the spiritualist ideas. One important one is always the Eye of Ra.
Yeah.
Always, a long time ago, seen as either the all-seeing eye or the kind of like the spiritual eye in a way. But it's interesting to know, if you actually cut the brain in half, it almost looks identical to the pineal gland.
Yeah, it does overlay, doesn't it? Yeah.
Which kind of makes you think that ancient cultures knew far more than we realise.
Mm.
Because one of the things I've realised that looking at ancient symbols and studying science and spirituality, you realise that these ancient symbols weren't just a symbol out of nowhere. They had precise meaning.
Mm.
And a lot of times that meaning was very scientific, which we're only just starting to realise in this day and age.
And precise geometry as well, I believe. Is it the Eye of Horus is broken down in this like mathematical equations?
Well, the Eye of Ra, Eye of Horus,
yeah.
Again, that goes down to Egypt splitting, recombining, splitting. So you've almost got like two different names for everything within the Egypt god culture. But it's interesting to note with another one, say like the Caduceus.
Caduceus of Mercury.
Yeah, with the twin snakes and the central pole. It's normally viewed as the Caduceus representing the double helix. Again, fascinating how we've only in the last 50 years known about the DNA double helix, and yet there it is represented in the ancient
thousands
symbol.
Thousands of years ago,
But it's not just representing the double helix DNA.
Mm.
It's also representing what I think to be the idea of a light wave in a three-dimensional...
Yeah, so if you just turn it on its side.
Yeah, but it also represents... The chakra system itself, because at each point of the snakes coiling around each other,
like a nodal point
of the chakra system,
yeah,
and so it's therefore representing the idea of the rising of the Kundalini, and that's one thing you'll find often within ancient symbols. It's not just representing one topic or one thing; it's representing many at the
same
time.
They're all overlaid, aren't they?
Exactly. And that's what you find, well, I'm only guessing at this point, with a lot of the initiatic schools.
Sure, yeah.
That they will always teach you how to decode the next stage when you're ready for it.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And that's why a lot of this knowledge isn't well known within society, because it's all what is hidden behind closed doors.
Mm.
And moving on now to one of the greatest symbols ever, within the spiritualist movement, and that would be the sacred geometry of the flower of life, seed of life, or even the egg of life.
Right.
Again, these are ancient symbols that have been known worldwide throughout the ages, and actually represent high-level mathematics, can actually represent the biological egg as it's forming within the womb. So all these things are represented over and over again within the sacred geometry.
It's like it's an unfolding.
Yeah, an unfolding of the universe. Well, they actually say within the flower of life symbol that it's meant to represent the Genesis, the book of Genesis, where the 7 days of creation with the seven circles of the flower. And one of the key points that I always like with that is in the Bible, it actually says on the fourth day of creation, half the pattern was complete. And again, you can see that when you actually create the pattern yourself, it's half complete on that fourth circle.
And of course, the flower of life is a symbol that's found in, you know, a lot of ancient sites, temples, and, you know, it runs through different... it's not owned by any one group, is it?
Again, it's seen over and over and over. What was it? The Egyptians, the Chinese... the Sumerians.
All these ancient cultures, you'll find it, won't you?
Yeah, so it is known worldwide. A couple more facts with this one is the Metatron's cube and the Platonic solids. So again, even though it's seen as a spiritual pattern, it has those very basis of our universe with those Platonic solids and the number systems actually embedded in the pattern. So this is most important symbol, pattern, however you want to describe it, in existence.
Is it also what I know about Metatron's cube when I first did a bit of research on it? It's actually, it's what keeps us anchored in the 3D?
It describes all basic geometric 3D patterns, but I really have no idea when it comes to keeping us anchored. But I know there's a lot more in the pattern. It's just a case of, like we say, the initiatic schools, having the eyes to see it, learning more about it. Well, finish off this subject, I would say the Phi and Fibonacci sequence are also embedded within this sacred geometry with the spirals that you see all over nature.
So what do you mean when you say the phi? Because I've heard it, but I'm not exactly sure what that means.
Well, the phi ratio, which I think is about 1.6, roughly speaking, denotes the ratio which you see over and over again in nature. So it's known as a phi ratio with a spiral pattern. Okay. So it's always increasing and going outwards.
Can it also be related to, say, I've seen it like the anatomy of an insect or general anatomy?
Yep. Because like I say, it's one of those number systems that is actually embedded within nature. So that's why you do see it over and over again.
Yeah, sure.
But mostly speaking within nature, it's more the Fibonacci style that you see rather than the pure phi.
And is that a repeating series of numbers, is it?
Yeah, that's the repeating series of numbers that if you actually take one and divide it by the other, so if you take 5 divided by 8, or vice versa, you'll actually get closer and closer to phi the higher up the Fibonacci sequence you go.
Right, okay.
And that's almost like the male, masculine and feminine aspects of the same thing.
So that's sort of like a model in which the way the universe is moving towards a point of singularity, almost like a point of, not perfection, but harmony.
It's almost towards that. The opposite of working towards a singularity, because it starts from the singularity and grows outwards. Out.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, so it's a symbolisation of growth.
Yeah.
Right, I just want to say that even though we keep going on about how science and spirituality always say the same thing, there are some contentious points within this subject. Because of myself, who's been studying both of these topics quite heavily for a long time now, I have my own pet hates or lack of understandings going on. Because no matter how much you try and introduce science into a spiritual understanding, there's a certain lack of knowledge there, or what I like to say, the difference in language that's spoken.
I think, also underpinning this, Mike, is people have a predisposition to sort of be anti-science, if you like. I think, from my own perspective, the way in which science was taught to me when I was a kid, many years ago now, it kind of, you know, turned me off to science, because you need that inspirational teacher. So, you know, quite a lot of spiritual types, if you like, they're already, I would suggest, predisposed to sort of see science as, well, how's this going to help my spiritual journey? How is this going to aid me? You know, it's like, that's science. That's a separate thing.
Yeah, definitely. So there is always that kind of like misunderstandings of the topic at hand.
Definitely.
But just to cover some of these contentious points.
Yeah.
I mean, I know this is a very simple one, but it always is one of my pet hates. That whenever you do a certain spiritual ritual or you go to a certain groups, they'll always talk about calling in the elements, or what element is that, earth, air, wind or fire, sort of thing. And that goes back to the days of the philosophers, where those were thought of the elements of the earth.
Right.
Whereas any scientist will know that they're not actually the elements, because the elements are what are contained within the periodic table. And what are they referring to with the so-called elements are actually what's known as states of matter.
Right.
So instead of wind, it's a gas.
Right.
Instead of earth, it's a solid.
Yeah.
Instead of
fire,
it's a plasma.
Yeah.
And instead of water, it's a liquid.
Right.
So, you know, I know it's not a big deal, but it's one of my pet hates that always comes up again and again and again. But on the other side of that, I'd say, like, most people in the scientific community, or most people in general, will actually dismiss astrology as being nonsense.
Okay.
But one big point I would make with that is the planets around you have an effect on you.
Yeah.
I mean, just to sum it up in simple terms, you take the two biggest influences that we have on our planet alone is going to be the sun and the moon. Because they affect the tides.
Yeah.
And then you've got to understand that we are mostly water.
Yeah.
So they affect us too. And another point to make on that one is when it comes to a full moon,
yeah,
the emergency services are called almost 10 times more than they
it's
usually
well noted,
are.
Isn't it? The increase.
Yeah. So it is well known that the moon has effect on our mental state.
Yeah.
And yes, I'll totally agree that the further the planet is away from us, the less of an effect it will have. But there's still a measurable effect.
Absolutely.
So even though I do dismiss the idea that half the stuff you read in the newspapers about astrology and what it means for you that day is a lot of bullshit.
Well, that's always really easy to discredit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's so generic.
But I do believe science does underpin the fact that there is something to it.
Mm.
Obviously, it notes further study.
Sure.
But I just wanted to point that out.
Cool.
And one thing I always find, another point within the spiritualist movement, is everyone goes on about crystals. And will say, oh, this crystal's fantastic for that. You know, this crystal's fantastic for that. But for my scientific mindset, I want to know, why is that crystal fantastic for that? You know, what in its structure gives it that properties? And it's something you'll never find in the spiritualist movement that will tell you. Which, for me, is a bit of an annoyance, but I guess that's something I'll find out eventually.
Would you also find, Mike, that if... I know from my own perspective, if I had a better understanding, because I have crystals... if I had the scientific understanding of why they have the effect they do, I'm sure they would. It would be more, you know, more of a positive effect... It'd have more of a positive effect on me.
So. Well, yeah, because of the whole placebo effect, because you're thinking it's got that effect, it pushes it on. But if it actually, you know more about it, it will improve that effect.
Definitely, yeah.
I mean, like, just to bring a tiny bit of physics into it, say, like, a crystal has a front-centred cubic pattern, will that mean it has a different effect to one that has a body-centred cubic pattern? But then again, that's something that I really do need to research more into. But on the flip side of this whole, you know, contentious points is that there are certain spiritual aspects that are being tested against the scientific rigour these days that have been proven to have a positive effect. So we're just going to mention a few here. Like, it has been well known and the idea of ayahuasca these days is growing more and more and more.
Yeah.
And it has been fairly proven now that certain ayahuasca ceremonies can actually heal diseases, cancers, that by scientific standards were considered uncurable. So that just goes to show that there is something behind the spiritualistic methodology.
I think we saw that there was a film out recently called Sacred Science, wasn't there?
Yeah.
It was very popular online. That demonstrated that effect.
Yeah, definitely. Another one that I read an article about recently, that the whole practice of smudging was proving to have an antibacterial and a cleansing effect within an area or a person for up to 24 hours.
Really? That long?
Yeah. So I have to admit, when I first got introduced to the idea of smudging, it seemed a lot of mumbo-jumbo to me.
Hocus pocus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But for then science to actually test it and go, well, actually, there's something to it, it just goes to show you that not everything's as you see it to begin with.
No, yeah, of course, yeah.
And another one that has been tested over and over again, and a lot more recently, is Buddhist monks have been connected to EEG machines.
Right.
And their brainwaves have been measured and monitored as they meditate.
Right.
And it does point out that the brainwave states change dramatically when they're in that state of meditation, beyond normal considerations of, like, your alpha, beta, and theta waves. They go into a far deeper state where it almost changes the way the mind makeup works. So meditation does have a true positive effect on the brain, and it has been scientifically studied at the moment.
They're really good examples.
So, in summary, the common misconceptions that science and spirituality have opposing views is unfounded and based on assumptions. By no means does science have all the answers yet, but at the same time, the spiritual understanding needs a bit more scientific rigour to ground it in the world. But hopefully, in the new age of enlightenment, we will see the rise of the spiritual scientists.
Yeah, and we'll see greater harmony, hopefully, between the two.
Definitely.
Yeah. Excellent.
So we're going to be leaving you now. Next week we're going to be talking about
the world of work.
Yeah, and how you can be an enlightened, conscious being in the workplace.
Right. Thank you very much, Mike. Cheers. No problem. Thanks, everyone.
Have a good day now. Bye.